from UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation. This is a Tales from the South Tin Roof Project.
Halfway around the world from my home, I had reached an absolute inhuman experience. I sat in the dirt beside a man who is more different from me than anyone else could possibly be.
Recorded in front of a live audience every Tuesday night during dinner at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas.
With an incredible shock that still often brings tears to my eyes, I realized that what I experienced in that moment was not his difference, but his sameness.
Sit back, relax, and let's reconnect with the power of a story.
Mistreated you like a girl, and I'm sorry. Come back to me, is my request.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? Honky Tonk Revitalists, the Salty Dogs from Little Rock, Arkansas, specialize in neo, country, western, and Bakersfield swing. Together since 2003, the band has recorded three albums and is working on their fourth. Their songs have been featured on the Sundance Channel, and they've shared the stage with, among others, Willie Nelson, Hank III, and George Jones. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a very special edition of Tales from the South, a monthly series we call the Tin Roof Project, where well-known Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temino's Publishing Company, and tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here strumming his 1931 National Resonator is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late bluesman Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. He wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Andrew Kilgore was born in Charlottesville, Virginia. After receiving a bachelor's degree in philosophy and attending seminary school, he went on to work as a Protestant minister in Vermont and the Peace Corps, where he was a volunteer in India and a mobility instructor in Texas for blind and disabled children. In 1973, Kilgore was hired by the University of Arkansas to develop a photography program. He worked as the photography instructor in the art department until 1977. During this period, the work of eccentric Heber Springs, Arkansas portrait photographer Michael Disfarmer surfaced, and Kilgore came across it during an exhibition in Fayetteville. Kilgore cites Disfarmer, along with professional photography luminaries such as Richard Avedon and Irving Penn, as the biggest influences on his own style. He retired from teaching in 1977 to work as a commercial photographer. Kilgore has since produced numerous photographic essays and exhibits, including the Fayetteville Town Folk Portfolio Project, which toured Arkansas. We drew a circle consisting of 80 images of the developmentally disabled, funded by Stevens Inc. and the National Endowment for the Humanities, and exhibited nationwide. Keeping in Touch, which was a project for the Arkansas AIDS Foundation. Arkansas People, a project for the Arkansas Sesquicentennial in 1986, spawning a book of the same name. Healing Changes, a series of images of the mentally ill. And Community Meals, a Reluctance to Engage, a series of photographs of the homeless, jobless, in which Kilgore exchanges a $20 bill for the right to take a subject's photograph. His life and work are being documented in the new documentary by Fiery Moon Productions entitled The Lens to the Soul, to be released in 2013. Andrew has lived in Fayetteville, Arkansas since 1971. By his own estimation, he has photographed more than 30,000 people in Arkansas between early 1971 and late 2001. Andrew Kilgore's appearance tonight on Tales from the South is in conjunction with the Arkansas Art Center's Images from the South traveling exhibit, where he is one of the artists, showing at William F. Lehman Public Library in January 2013. Tonight, Andrew first goes halfway across the world, then not so far from home, to discover a truth in deepest intention. Ladies and gentlemen, Andrew Kilgore.
It was 1968, and I was a Peace Corps volunteer in northern India. I had been in India for about 18 months and had adopted Indian clothing and probably more than a few Indian mannerisms. I lived alone. I was the only white person for many kilometers. My home in America had become a distant, unreal dream. One of my responsibilities took me to a small rural village about 10 miles from the town where I lived. On this particular day, I had taken the bus to within a mile of the village and then walked the rest of the way. Now I was walking back to where I would catch the bus for the return trip. It was the long, hot, dry season that comes before the monsoon. Daytime temperatures went well over 120 degrees, and because it hadn't rained for months, it was very dry. A powerful hot wind called the Lu blew so strongly out of the west that you could lean into it as you walked. I carried an umbrella to protect me from the sun, but I had to walk with it faced into the wind so that it wouldn't blow away. The heat from the sun was a tangible force that held and embraced me. Every step was a struggle. Finally, I reached the place where the bus would stop to pick me up. There was a tea vendor there, hunkered down in a tiny open shack, who gave me some water to drink and began to fix me a strong, milky tea, which he would serve to me in a small, clear glass. Even after 45 years, my memories of this particular afternoon seemed so very clear. As I sat on the ground looking down the dusty road for the approach of the bus, I saw what seemed like a stick figure gradually appear out of the heat mirage. A small, terribly thin, very dark man, dressed in nothing more than a rag around his loins, with a large basket balanced on his head, walked up and carefully sat down beside me. He was probably an untouchable or a very low-caste person. The rag around his middle might well have been his only possession. His basket was filled with small empty bottles that he had been paid, probably less than a penny, to carry many miles through this awful heat. His skin was dried out and brittle. The calluses on his feet were so thick that the cracks in them went a quarter of an inch deep into his foot. As I looked at this man, I realized that there was nowhere on this earth where I could find a person more different from myself than him. Halfway around the world from my home, I had reached an absolute in human experience. I sat in the dirt beside a man who is more different from me than anyone else could possibly be. With an incredible shock that still often brings tears to my eyes, I realized that what I experienced in that moment was not his difference, but his sameness. That in fact, he and I were one. That his most basic inner experience of himself and my most basic inner experience of myself, stripped of all culture and personal history, were exactly the same. 40 years later, about 5 years ago actually, I was driving to Little Rock from where I live in Fayetteville to do some photographic work, and I was listening to a talk CD to pass the time. Actually, it was a self-help CD. I admit it, sometimes I listen to self-help CDs. Anyway, the recommendation on this particular CD was to pick the one thing that we absolutely most want, and then to put the full weight of our most powerful, most committed intention behind that one thing. To make that one thing the most important thing in our lives, the thing around which everything else rotates. Now, ordinarily, my life being the mess that it is, I would have picked to be a thinner or richer or possibly to fall deeply in love with some incredible woman who would, of course, fall deeply in love with a thinner, richer me. But on this particular day, something different happened. I found myself being drawn into a simpler and more honest place. I wondered if I really were to set everything else aside, if, for example, I had to spend the rest of my life in one small room with just one intention, one great desire, what would it be? And I realized that my real primary intention is to know God now. And then those four words, to know God now, began to echo and re-echo in my mind. And suddenly I felt this rush of feeling and awareness wash through me. And I felt different, changed. Changed in two ways. First, I was no longer alone in that car. I knew God was physically there, inside me and outside me. I was aware of God, being aware of me, knowing me by name. And second, I felt really good. More than good, exhilarated. Not happy exactly, different from happy, better than happy. I felt joy. The traditional word for what I felt is joy. Joy is different from happy. Joy is kind of like that heart-stopping feeling that you get when you look someone right in the eye and say for the first time, I love you, and they look right back into your eyes and say, I love you too. And you know that they really mean it, and there's that incredible snap of connection, real connection. And that's how I felt in that moment, connected to a knowing presence who was really there, who was aware of me, eye to eye and heart to heart, who was loving me and that I was loving back, God. And those four words that started this whole thing, to know God now, changed to know you now. God had become, has become, a you for me. God is a person, a knowing presence inside me and outside me, whom I get to address as you. And every time I turn to God and say, you, I love you, I am flooded with this incredible feeling of joy. Though I didn't realize it at the time, that day back in 1968 in India was a turning point in my life, as that profound recognition has always informed and empowered my life and my work as a portrait photographer, even to this day. And I have to report to you that my experience in the car 40 years later has also turned out to be a turning point in my life. That now I experience God's real presence every day. I am aware of God being aware of me every day, not continuously, but for a few moments here and a few moments there. And that feeling of a quiet, exhilarated joy floods through me in each one of those moments every time. And now the second most important thing in my life has become to try and communicate to other people what this experience, these experiences are like. To see if what I experience resonates with anyone else. to extend this sense of connection to people and to God, to everyone. When Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself, a doorway opens into a moment of grace and mystery that sinks deep beneath all of the surface concerns, all the words of our human lives, to a place where only you and I and God exist. A mystic is a person whose absolutely deepest desire is to experience directly the real, immediate, physical presence of God. Hi, my name is Andrew, and I'm a mystic.
So thank you so much, Andrew Kilgore, for being on the Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South. The incredible scene in India with the man that you originally thought of as your opposite, but realized that you were in fact the same. This connection, you say, informed the rest of your life and your work. So can you expand on this a little bit for us?
Sure. As I began to photograph, at first, I just photographed, garbage cans and trees and everything that any beginning photographer photographs. But pretty soon people told me that the photographs that seemed to be the best, to resonate the most, were the pictures that I took of people. And I began to really work with that. And as I worked with that, I realized that I just loved to look deeply into the eyes of other human beings, and particularly all different kinds of other beings, human beings. Well, beings. I like dogs and cats, too, actually. But over time, I remembered that experience in India, and I realized the whole Peace Corps experience, I think that story just is kind of one illustration of what the whole experience was like. To experience people who are so different from me, whose culture and language and ways of saying yes, in India they go like that to say yes, as I recall, it's been a while. But I realized that experience had driven me to a place where I just love to look deeply into other people and always feel that sense of oneness, that sense of connection with them. Does that help?
Mm-hmm. And I think I've read, and I may say it wrong, but do you call it the ineffable connection?
The ineffable. Ineffable is like, bad jokes. Clark wanted me to make bad jokes tonight. I was going to say it's ineffable is a connection that you can't F, but that's really...
that's a pretty bad joke.
It's a connection that goes deeply beneath that level where we communicate connection with words. It's that sense of connection which is so immediate and present and real to us that we can't ever quite seem to find the words to put it into.
Mm. And I think that's what people are drawn to in your photography. The same thing you're drawn to, that when we look, I don't know about the audience here.
Something we share.
That's right. Yeah, I think so. Many people have gone to India for spiritual enlightenment, and though you didn't know it at the time, you actually did the same thing. So were there other stories from this time period of your life or other time periods where you learned an unexpected lesson from an unexpected source?
When you ask me that question, what immediately comes to my mind is a time, actually quite a few years later, when actually it was a Palm Sunday 20 years ago, 21 years ago maybe. Anyway, I woke up that Sunday morning and I realized that I was desperately ill. I mean, very, very ill. And I called a friend who, and they took me to the hospital. And I was so ill that I couldn't even sit in the waiting room to wait to see the doctor. And they took me back and they put me on a examination table. And I remember I was laying there on that table holding one hand being held by one friend and the other hand being held by another friend, and I just felt like I was going to die. I felt it's the closest I've ever felt to actually dying. It turned out I had double pneumonia. I couldn't breathe. My head hurt really bad. I had no energy, and I just felt myself approaching that portal, that place. I knew I could die, and suddenly what I felt was this overwhelming sense of being loved. And it was weird because my body was still scared to death, literally. But this other part of me experienced this sense of being loved to the point where I realized that somehow, in some weird way, it didn't matter whether I lived or died, that my experience of life would be the same. And that sense of being loved, and who would expect, and it's that sense of, I can always go back to that place. I remember that place really, really well. Years later, I was trying to think of I've always been kind of weird about praying for other people. And I was trying to think, well, you know, how do you pray for other people? I mean, it's weird. You know, if the God thing is real, then God's got his ideas or her ideas about what other people need or should have. So I've always been reluctant to try and give God instructions for how he should. But I realized that what I could pray, may that person know how deeply loved they are. How deeply loved they are. And those experiences came out of places that I would never have expected that kind of insight and spiritual instruction, if you will, to, mm-hmm. to come.
Had you ever written about either of the experiences in your life from this story? Had you written about those before?
Actually, I've got about 40 pages of stuff in here that we could be here all night.
And so is there a memoir in the works?
Are we going to see a memoir one day? There are a couple of book ideas that I'm working on right now. But
oh, good.
Oh, thanks. Inspiration. Now, if you'll follow that up with some money, we'll be all set. Actually, the project that I'm most interested in right now is the Community Meals project that I'm doing in Fayetteville about people who experience perennial poverty. And I'm learning so much about, and going through changes every day about how I understand what life is like for people whose lives are so challenged by just the ordinary struggle to have enough food to eat or a safe place to sleep. And I think I want to do that next rather than a memoir type of book.
I'm curious from your story, and others might be too. Do you remember the name of the self-help CD? Because I might have to go get a copy.
I can't remember. I think it might have been one of those Abraham, maybe some of you have been familiar with the Abraham CDs. Or it might have been Eckhart Tolle. I know I was listening to a lot of Eckhart Tolle right then. But no, I can't really remember exactly which one it was.
All right, well, we have a few minutes here at the end for audience questions.
10 years ago, I was fortunate enough to work with Connie Fales at the Clinton Museum. She says, what if we did a calendar for breast cancer survivors? It was really great. We did a calendar, and then Barnes & Noble picked it up. And you did a number of images in the calendar of breast cancer survivors that were really spectacular. So I don't know if you remember that, but that was so iconic and wonderful. And just want you to comment about that time.
I remember doing that project with Connie Fales. It was a good time. I've gotten to do a lot of small projects along the way that have meant a lot to me, and that certainly was one of them. Another one that comes to mind, kind of similar to that, I was approached by this woman who is a medical anthropologist, and she was working in one of the hospitals, and as an anthropologist, they had discovered that there was a higher rate of fatality amongst African-American women due to breast cancer than other populations of people, and the reason was because African-American, middle-class African-American women are very reluctant to talk about their bodies. So they organized a speaking group of African-American survivors, and these women would go out to different luncheon groups and church groups and talk about their experience in an effort to get women to become more aware and catch that awful disease earlier in its process. And I got to photograph this group of women, and they were just the most incredible women. It was a really great time. And I understand that was during the Clinton years, and I understand that one of those photographs was actually hung in the White House for a brief period of time. I'm sure the Bushes took it down.
But the photograph back there, is that Tim West?
No, it isn't. It looks a lot like Tim, mm-hmm. though. I haven't photographed Tim in a long time. But no, this is another man that I know from that group that I'm photographing at Community Meals. I made that photograph just 6 or 8 months ago, I guess.
Andrew, you have a very well-developed knack for capturing the essence of the personality of the person that you're photographing. A lot of people, they get in front of the camera and they get uptight, or, you know, that doesn't come out very easily, or they go into some other showbiz persona or something. You mentioned Dis Farmer's work and his impact on you. Could you speak just a little bit to how you, is that just a natural born trait, or you pull that out of people when they're in front of your camera, or is that something that was kind of learned or developed?
I think that probably, you know, this is something I've thought about a lot, and it's kind of a mysterious thing, because I've known a lot of really wonderful photographers who didn't have that ability to make a really compelling portrait. I think a lot of it is what the writing was about. It's just that sense of being one with another person, and not of being very present with someone, but without being intrusive, without trying to manipulate them very obviously. I do things like get confused about how my camera works, or stumble over part of some of the equipment, or basically act the fool to put people at ease. I do that a lot, but I keep talking to people. Actually, somebody asked me several years ago, after I had talked to them for an hour or so, and then we started to do the photography, and they said, "Oh, I bet you talk to people for so long before you photograph, so that you understand them better and you can make a better photograph." And I said, "Actually, you have it exactly backwards. I photograph people so that I get to talk to them. I don't talk to them so that I can photograph them."
What would you say to a new photographer, somebody who's starting out, what the difference is, what the line is between exploitation and a shared human experience in your work, and how to achieve that?
Oh, wow, that's a really hard question. But what immediately comes to mind is a bunch of excuses for not answering your question. I'd have to know the photographer and see their work. Exploitation. I've worried sometimes that maybe some of the work that I've done was exploitive in some way. One of the things that I do, I don't try to fix people or save people. I let people be who they are. I think that's important. The fondness that I feel for people is very genuine. I really do like people. And maybe part of the answer to that question is to always be aware that that's a question. You know, that that's something to be sensitive to. So that, and to be worried about, you know, not to become facile in your way of dealing with people, but to continue to be at least a little bit troubled by the possibility that you might not be doing it right.
You photographed my nephews when they were probably 5 or 6, and we have the pictures in my brother's living room, and they call to me literally every time I walk through the room. So thank you so much. It's just a pleasure to tell you that. And my question is, after your self-help car experience, how has that informed your photography since that point? Has it changed?
I don't think so. I think it's changed a lot of other things in my life, but I think it's maybe made the photograph experience a little bit richer. One of the things that I talk about, being able to experience the presence of God inside of myself and outside of myself, and part of the outside of myself is that when I look into another person's eyes, I see God looking back at me, particularly when it occurs to me too, you know, but when I'm photographing, everything else just falls away, and it's just me and that other person and the process of being with them, and I don't conceptualize that very much.
I have a beloved picture that you took of my mom and me about 23 or 24 years ago. And kind of related to that question, how do you think about your photographs after the session has ended? Do you think about what kind of life they take on when they're in the hands of the person you're photographing, or, you know, 30,000 people over the course of your career? What does that mean to you?
It means a great deal to me. It means a whole lot to me. I love the notion that long after I'm gone, the photographs that I've made for people will still be hanging on their walls and will still be reminding them of the people that they love, and that work will have had some real value for other people. I love the notion of that. I work hard on the photograph. I'm a print guy. I love to make photographic prints. And prints are a real wonderful way to share the work with the people who are in the pictures and with other people who might see them. But I work real hard. I work as hard on the prints, or maybe harder sometimes, than I do on the process of photographing itself. And part of it is to be able to, I studied philosophy and theology and it was all words, 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 words. So when I found something I could do physically, where at the end of a work day, I had a physical product that I could put in somebody else's hands that would mean something to them, I really like that a lot.
All right, so thank you so much, Andrew Kilgore, for being on our Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South. More can be found out about Andrew, his photography, and the upcoming documentary on andrewkilgore.com. So how about our story and storyteller tonight? Thank you to our live audience. Thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, with additional support provided by the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.